Understand. Okay, I'm interested to read the two chapters of Lotus Sutra, not the full one, but I'm going to take the main portion of the 16 chapter, and then later on the third chapter. The 16th chapter, all of you got the handouts. Okay, the 16th chapter of Lotus Sutra, the lifespan of the Thus Come One. At that time, the Buddha spoke to the Bodhisattvas and all the great assembly. Good men, you must believe and understand the truthful words of the Thus Come One. And again he said to the great assembly, you must believe and understand the truthful words of the Thus Come One. And once more he said to the great assembly, you must believe and understand the truthful words of the Thus Come One. It's kind of three times saying to make it his point more clear. At the time, the Bodhisattvas and the great assembly with Maitreya as their leader pressed their palms together and addressed the Buddha saying, World Honored One, we beg you to explain. We will believe and accept the Buddha's words. They spoke in this manner three times and then said once more, we beg you to explain it. We will believe and accept the Buddha's words. At that time, the World Honored One, seeing that the Bodhisattvas repeated their request three times and more, spoke to them, saying, you must listen carefully and hear to the Thus Come One secret and his transcendental powers. In all the worlds and heavenly and human beings and asuras, all believe that the present Shakyamuni Buddha, after leaving the palace of the Shakyas, seated himself in the palace and practiced not far from the city of Gaya and then attained Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. But good men, it has been immeasurable, boundless, hundreds, thousands, 10,000, millions of Naivtas, of Kalpas, since I in fact attained Buddhahood. Suppose a person were to take 500, 1,000, 10,000, a million, Nayuta, Asamkhya, 1,000, million fold worlds and grind them to dust. Then moving eastward each time he passes 500, 1,000, 10,000, a million, Nayuta, Asamkhya worlds, he drops a particle of dust. He continues eastward in this way until he has finished dropping all the particles. Good man, what is your opinion? Can the total number of all these worlds he imagined or calculated? The Bodhisattva Maitreya and the other said to the Buddha, World Honored One, these worlds are immeasurable, boundless. One cannot calculate their numbers, nor does the mind have the power to encompass them. Even all the voice hearers and pratek Buddhas with their wisdom free of outflows could not imagine or understand how many there are. Although we abide in the stage of Abhivartika, we cannot comprehend such a manner. World Honored One, these worlds are immeasurable and boundless. At that time, the Buddha said to the multitude of great Bodhisattvas, good men, now I will state this to you clearly. Suppose all these worlds, whether they received a particle of dust or not, are once more reduced to dust. Let one particle represent one kalpa. Then the time that has passed since I attained Buddhahood surpasses this by 100, 1,000, 10,000, a million Nayuta, Asamkhya kalpas. Ever since then I have been constantly in this Saha world, preaching the law, teaching and converting, and elsewhere I have led and benefited living beings in 100,000, 10,000, millions of Nayutas and Asamkhya of lands. Good men, during that time I have spoken about the Buddha burning touch and others, and describe how they entered Nirvana. All this I employed as an expedient means to make distinctions. Good men, if there are living beings who come to me, I employ my Buddha eye to observe their faith and to see if their other faculties are keen or dull. And then, depending upon how receptive they are to salvation, I appear in different places and preach to them under different names and describe the length of time during which my teaching will be effective. Sometimes when I make my appearance, I say that I am about to enter Nirvana, and also employ different expedient means to preach the subtle and wonderful law, thus causing living beings to awaken joyful minds. Good men, the thus come one observes how among living beings there are those who delight in a little law, meager in virtue and heavy with defilements. For such persons, I describe how in my youth I left my household and attained Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. But in truth, the time since I attained Buddhahood is extremely long, and I have told you. It is simply that I use this expedient means to teach and convert living beings and cause them to enter the Buddha way. That is why I speak in this manner. Good men, the scriptures expounded by the thus come one are all for the purpose of saving and emancipating living beings. Sometimes I speak of myself, sometimes of others, sometimes I present myself, sometimes others, sometimes I show my own actions, sometimes those of others. All that I preach is true and not false. Why do I do this? The thus come one perceives the true aspect of the threefold world exactly as it is. There is no ebb or flow of birth and death, and there is no existing in this world and later entering extinction. It is neither substantial nor empty, neither consistent nor diverse, nor is it what those who dwell in the threefold world perceive it to be. All such things the thus come one sees clearly and without error. Because living beings have different natures, different desires, different actions, and different ways of thinking and making distinctions, and because I want to enable them to put down good roots, I employ a variety of causes and conditions, similes, parables, and phrases to preach different doctrines. This is the Buddha's work. I have never for a moment neglected. Thus, since I attained Buddhahood, an extremely long period of time has passed. My lifespan is immeasurable number of asankhya kalpas, and during that time I have constantly abided here without ever entering extinction. Good men, originally I practiced the Bodhisattva way, and the lifespan that acquired then has yet come to an end, but will last twice the number of years that I have already passed. Now, however, although in fact I do not actually enter extinction, I announce that I am going to adopt the course of extinction. This is an expedient means with which the thus come one uses to teach and convert living beings. Why do I do this? Because if the Buddha remains in the world for a long time, those persons with shallow virtue will fail to plant good roots, but living in poverty and lowliness will become attached to the five desires and be caught in the net of deluded thoughts and imaginings. If they see that the thus come one is constantly in the world and never enters extinction, they will grow arrogant and selfish or become discouraged and neglectful. They will fail to realize how difficult it is to encounter the Buddha and will not approach him with a respectful and reverent mind. Therefore, as an expedient means, the thus come one says, monks, you should know that it is a rare thing to live at a time when one of the Buddhas appear in the world. Why does he do this? Because persons of shallow virtue may pass immeasurable hundreds, thousands, 10,000, millions of kalpas, with some of them chancing to see a Buddha and others never seeing one at all. For this reason, I say to them, monks, the thus come one is hard to get to see. When living beings hear these words, they are certain to realize how difficult it is to encounter the Buddha. In their minds, they will harbor a longing and will thirst to gaze upon the Buddha. And then they will work to plant good roots. Therefore, the thus come one, though in truth he does not enter extinction, speaks of passing into extinction. Good men, the Buddhas and thus come one all preach a law such as this. They act in order to save living beings. So what they do is true and not false. Suppose, for example, that there is a skillful physician who is wise and understanding and knows how to compound medicines to effectively cure all kind of diseases. He has many sons, perhaps 10, 20 or even 100. He goes off to some other land far away to see about a certain affair. After he has gone, the children drink some kind of poison that makes them distraught with pain and they fall writhing to the ground. At that time, the father returns to his home and finds that his children have drunk poison. Some are completely out of their minds, while others are not. Seeing their father from far off, all are overjoyed and kneel down entreat him, saying, "How fine that you have returned safely. We were stupid and by mistake drank some poison. We beg you to cure us and let us live out our lives." The father, seeing his children suffering like this, follows various prescriptions, gathering fine medicinal herbs that meet all the requirements of color, fragrance, and flavor. He grinds, shifts, and mixes them together, giving a dose of those to his children and tells them, "This is a highly effective medicine, meeting all the requirements of color, fragrance, and flavor. Take it, and you will quickly be relieved of your sufferings and will be free of all illnesses." Those children who have not lost their senses can see that this is good medicine, outstanding in both color and fragrance, and they take it immediately and are completely cured of their sicknesses. Those who are out of their minds are equally delighted to see their father return and beg him to cure their sicknesses, but when they are given the medicine, they refuse to take it. Why? Because the poison has penetrated deeply and their minds no longer function as before. So although the medicine is of excellent color and fragrance, they do not perceive it as good. The father thinks to himself, "My poor children, because of the poison in them, their minds are completely befuddled. Although they are happy to see me and ask me to cure them, they refuse to take this excellent medicine. I must now resort to some expedient means to induce them to take the medicine." So he says to them, "You should know that I am now old and worn out, and the time of my death has come. I will leave this good medicine here. You should take it and not worry that it will not cure you." Having given these instructions, he then goes off to another land, where he sends a messenger home to announce, "Your father is dead." At that time, the children, hearing that their father has deserted them and died, are filled with great grief and consternation and think of themselves, "If our father were alive, he would have pity on us and see that we are protected. But now he has abandoned us and died in some other country far away. We are shelterless orphans and no one to rely on." Constantly harboring such feelings of grief, they at last come to their senses and realize that the medicine is in fact excellent in color and fragrance and flavor, and so they take it and are healed of all the effects of the poison. The father, hearing that the children are all cured, immediately returns home and appears to them all once more. Good men, what is your opinion? Can anyone say that this skillful physician is guilty of lying? No, world honored one. The Buddha said, "It is the same way, same with me. It has been immeasurable boundless hundreds, thousands, 10,000, millions of Nayuta and Asamkha Kalpas since I attained Buddhahood. But for the sake of living beings, I employ the power of expedient means and say that I am about to pass into extinction in view of the circumstances. However, no one can say that I have been guilty of lies or falsehood. Now there's the in verse, the same thing it says. I'm not going to read that because that will be repetition. And I will turn to the page, the chapter 3. Is it reading too fast? No, it's good.
Just
The third chapter, simile and parable. At that time, Shariputra's mind then. Oh, I'm not going to read the first part. No, the first part is. Skip the first part that about the Sariputta becoming the Tathagata. Yeah, okay. Okay, here is the parable of burning house starts from the page 56, middle of the page 56. Suppose that in a certain town, in a certain country, there was a very rich man. He was far along in years and his wealth was beyond measure. He had many fields, houses and men servants. His own house was big and rambling, but it had only one gate. A great many people, 100, 200, perhaps as many as 500, lived in the house. The halls and rooms were old and decaying, the walls crumbling, the pillars rotten at their base, and the beams and rafters crooked and aslant. At that time, a fire suddenly broke out on all sides, spreading through the rooms of the house. The sons of the rich man, 10, 20, perhaps 30, were inside the house. When the rich man saw the huge flames leaping up on every side, he was greatly alarmed and fearful and thought to himself, I can escape to safety through the flaming gate, but my sons are inside the burning house, enjoying themselves and playing games, unaware, unknowing, without alarm or fear. The fire is closing in on them. Suffering and pain threaten them. Yet their minds have no sense of loathing or peril, and they do not think of trying to escape. Shariputta, this rich man, thought to himself, I have strength in my body and arms. I can wrap them in a robe or place them on a bench and carry them out of the house. And then again he thought, this house has only one gate, and moreover, it is narrow and small. My sons are very young. They have no understanding, and they love their games, being so engrossed in them that they are likely to be burned in the fire. I must explain to them why I am fearful and alarmed. The house is already in flames, and I must get them out quickly and not let them be burned up in the fire. Having thought in this way, he followed his plan and called to all his sons, saying, you must come out at once. But though the father was moved by pity and gave good words of instruction, the sons were absorbed in their games and unwilling to heed him. They had no alarm, no fright, and in the end, no mind to leave the house. Moreover, they did not understand what the fire was and the house was, what danger was. The merely raised about this way and that in play and looked at their father without heeding him. At the time, the rich man had this thought. The house is already in flames from this huge fire. If I and my sons do not get out at once, we are certain to be burned. I must now invent some expedient means that will make it possible for the children to escape harm. The father understood his sons and knew what various toys and curious objects each children customarily like and what would delight them. And so he said to them, the kind of plaything you like are rare and hard to find. If you do not take them when you can, you will surely regret it later. For example, things like these goat carts, deer carts and ox carts. They are outside the gate now where you can play with them. So you must come out of this burning house at once. Then whatever ones you want, I will give them all to you. At the time when the sons heard their father telling them about these rare playthings, because such things were just what they had wanted, each felt emboldened in heart, and pushing and shoving one another, they all came wildly dashing out of the burning house. At this time, the rich man, seeing that his sons had gotten out safely and all were seated on the open ground at the crossroads and were no longer in danger, was greatly relieved, and his mind danced for joy. At the time, each of the sons said to his father, "The playthings you promised us earlier, the goat carts, the deer carts and ox cart, please give them to us now." Shariputra, at that time, the rich man gave to each of his son a large carriage of uniform size and quality. The carriage were tall and spacious and adorned with numerous jewels. A railing ran all around them and bells hung from all four sides. A canopy was stretched over the top, which was also decorated with an assortment of precious jewels. Ropes of jewels twined around, a fringe of flowers hung down, and layers of cushions were spread inside, on which were placed vermilion pillows. Each carriage was drawn by a white ox, pure and clean in hide, handsome in form and of great strength, capable of pulling the carriage smoothly and properly at a pace fast as the wind. In addition, there were many grooms and servants to attend and guard the carriage. What was the reason for this? This rich man's wealth was limitless, and he had many kinds of storehouses that were all filled and overflowing. He thought to himself, "There is no end to my possessions. It would not be right if I were to give my sons small carriages of inferior make. These little boys are all my sons, and I love them without partiality. I have countless numbers of large carriages adorned with seven kinds of gem. I should be fair-minded and give one to each of my sons. I should not show any discrimination. Why? Because even if I distributed these possessions of mine to every person in the whole country, I would still not exhaust them. Much less could I do so by giving them to my sons." At that time, each of the sons mounted his large carriage, gaining something he had never had before, something he had originally never expected. Shariputra, what do you think of this? When this rich man impartially handed out to his sons these big carriages adorned with rare jewels, was he guilty or falsehood or not? Shariputra said, "No, O world honored one, this rich man simply made it possible for his sons to escape the peril of fire and preserve their lives. He did not commit a falsehood. Why do I say this? Because if they were able to preserve their lives, then they had already obtained a plaything of sorts. And how much more so when, through an expedient means, they are rescued from that burning house. World Honor One, even if the rich man had not given them the tiniest carriage, he would still not be guilty of falsehood. Why? Because this rich man had earlier made up his mind that he would employ an expedient means to cause his sons to escape. Using a device of this kind was not act of falsehood. How much less so then when the rich man knew that his wealth was limitless and he intended to enrich and benefit his sons by giving each of them a large carriage. The Buddha said to Shariputra, "Very good, very good. It is just as you have said." And Shariputra, the thus come one is like this, he is a father to all the world. His fears, cares and anxieties, ignorance and misunderstanding have long come to an end, leaving no residue. He has fully succeeded in acquiring measureless insight, power and freedom from fear, and gaining great supernatural powers and the power of wisdom. He is endowed with expedient means and the paramita of wisdom. His great pity and great compassion are constant and unflagging. at all times he seeks what is good and will bring benefit to all. He is born into the threefold world, a burning house, rotten and old, in order to save living beings from the fires of birth, old age, sickness and death, care, suffering, stupidity, misunderstanding and the three poisons, to teach and convert them and enable them to attain Anuttara Sammyak Sambodhi. He sees living beings sheared and consumed by birth, old age, sickness and death, care and suffering, sees them undergo many kinds of pain because of the five desires and the desire of wealth and profit. Again, because of their greed and attachment and striving, they undergo numerous pains in their present existence, and later they undergo the pain of being reborn in hell or as beasts or hungry spirits. Even if they are reborn in the heavenly realm or the realm of human beings, they undergo the pain of poverty and want, the pain of parting from loved ones, the pain of encountering those they detest, and all these many different kinds of pain. Yet living beings drowned in the midst of all this delight and amuse themselves unaware, unknowing, without alarm or fear. They feel no sense of loathing and make no attempt to escape. In this burning house, which is the threefold world, they race about to east and west, and though they encounter great pain, they are not distressed by it. Shariputra, when the Buddha sees this, then he thinks to himself, I am the father of living beings. I should rescue them from their suffering and give them the joy of measureless and boundless Buddha wisdom so that they may find their enjoyment in that. Shariputra, the thus come one, also has this thought. If I should merely employ supernatural powers and the power of wisdom, if I should set aside expedient means and for the sake of living beings, should praise the thus come ones inside power and freedom from fear, then living beings would not be able to gain salvation. Why? Because these living beings have not yet escaped from birth, old age, sickness, death, care and suffering, but are consumed by flames in the burning house that is the threefold world. How could they be able to understand the Buddha's wisdom? Shariputra, that rich man, though he had strength in his body and arms, did not use it. He merely employed carefully contrived expedient means and thus was able to rescue his sons from the peril of the burning house, and afterward gave each of them a large carriage adorned with rare jewels. And the thus come one does the same. Though he possesses power and freedom from fear, he does not use this. He merely employs wisdom and expedient means to rescue living beings from the burning house of the threefold world, expounding to them the three vehicles, the vehicle of the voice hearer, that of the Pratyeka Buddhas, and that of the Buddha. He says to them, you must not be content to stay in this burning house of the threefold world. Do not be greedy for its coarse and shoddy forms, sound, scent, taste, and senses, sensations. If you become attached to them and learn to love them, you will be burned up. You must come out of this threefold world at once so that you can acquire the three vehicles, the vehicles of the voice hearer, the Pratyeka Buddha and the Buddha. I promise you now that you will get them, and that promise will never prove false. You have only to apply yourselves with diligent effort. The thus come one employs this expedient means to lure living beings into action. And then he says to them, you should understand that these doctrines of the three vehicles are all praised by the sages. They are free, without entanglements, leaving nothing further to depend upon or seek. Mount these three vehicles, gain roots and are without outflows, gain powers, awareness and way, the way, meditation, emancipation, samadhis, and then enjoy yourself. You will gain the delight of immeasurable peace and safety. Shariputra, if there are living beings who are inwardly wise in nature and who attain the Buddha, the world-honored one, hear the law, believe and accept it, and put forth diligent effort, desiring to escape quickly from the threefold world and seeking to attain Nirvana, they shall be called those who ride the vehicle of the voice hearer. They are like those sons who left the burning house in the hope of acquiring goat carts. If there are living beings who attend the Buddha, the world-honored one, hear the law, believe and accept it, and put forth diligent effort, seeking wisdom that comes of itself, taking solitary delight in goodness and tranquility, and profoundly understanding the causes and conditions of all phenomena, they shall be called those who ride the vehicle of Pratyeka Buddha. They are like the sons who left the burning house in the hope of acquiring deer curds. If there are living beings who attend the Buddha, the world-honored one, hear the law, believe and accept it, and put forth diligent effort, seeking comprehensive wisdom, Buddha wisdom, wisdom that comes of itself, teacherless wisdom, the insight of the thus come one, powers and freedom from fear, who pity and comfort countless living beings, being benefit to heavenly, bring benefit to heavenly and human beings, and save them all. They shall be called those who ride the great vehicle. Because the bodhisattvas seek this vehicle, they call mahasattvas. They are like the sons who left the burning house in the hope of acquiring ox carts. Sariputta, that rich man, seeing that his sons had all gotten out of the burning house safely and were no longer threatened, recalled that his wealth was immeasurable and presented each of his sons with a large carriage. And the thus come one does likewise. He is the father of all living beings. When he sees that countless thousands of millions of living beings through the gateway of the Buddha's teaching can escape the pains of the threefold world, the fearful and perilous road, and gain the delights of nirvana, the thus come one at that time has this thought: I possess measureless, boundless wisdom, power, fearlessness, the storehouse of law of the Buddhas. These living beings are all my sons. I will give the great vehicle to all of them equally, so that there will not be those who gain extinction by themselves, but that all may do so through the extinction of the thus come one. To all the living beings who have escaped from the threefold world, he then gives the delightful gifts of the meditation, emancipation, and so forth of the Buddhas. All these are uniform in characteristics, uniform in type, praised by the sages, capable of producing pure, wonderful, supreme delight. Shariputra, that rich man, first used the three types of carriages to entice his sons, but later he gave them just a large carriage adorned with jewels, the safest, most comfortable kind of all. Despite this, that rich man was not guilty of falsehood. The thus come one does the same. He is without falsehood. First he preaches the three vehicles to attain the guide the living beings, but later he employs just the great vehicle to save them. Why? The thus come one possesses measureless wisdom, power, freedom from fear, the storehouse of the law. He is capable of giving to all living beings the law of the great vehicle, but not all of them are capable of receiving it. Sariputra, for this reason, you should understand that the Buddhas employ the power of expedient means, and because they do so, they make distinctions in the one Buddha vehicle and preach it all three. Okay. So, there's still time, you can comment on it or something.
Yes, let me first. All right, well, we have, with this morning's class, we have come to the halfway point in our course. So I think I would like to take a couple of moments now just to remind you of two elements of the course that may be somewhat less desirable to all of you than listening to the lectures. I don't know how desirable that is either, but first of all, part of the requirements of the course are that you write a short essay of about 2,000 words on any subject of your choice contained in the course. there isn't any particular hurry about this, but I think you should start to think about what you might like to write about, and when you have an idea, just come to me and just clear it with me, and I will, if I think necessary, I will make some suggestions, and if not, then I will just note it down, and then you can proceed to work on that essay on that particular theme that you've chosen. 2,000 words is not very long. If you're using a word processor, it's about 4 or 5 pages. The reason for the essay is really to just to give you some practice in formulating your ideas and writing them out clearly. It will be beneficial to you in the course of your studies and your future studies. Writing short essays is very common practice in Western universities. In Asia, students hardly write except at exam time, and as a result, their writing skills don't develop. So I would like to ask you all to make the effort to write these short essays on some topic of your choice. And as I say, that will be beneficial to you. It will also help you when we come to the next element of the course, which is the midterm exam and the final exam, which will be essay questions. So the practice that you gain through writing will help you also to deal with the midterm and the final exams. Now, regarding the midterm and the final exams, we have prepared some review questions covering the topics that we will cover this week. As I say, we are now at the midpoint of the course. We have done the origins of the Mahayana, and we've done the Lotus Sutra, and we still have the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, in particular the Heart Sutra, and then the Lankavatara Sutra to study, but we are at the halfway point. So, as I say, we have prepared review questions for this first week of the course, covering these four areas, and we were talking about this morning, and we thought that perhaps since we have on Saturday 2 hours of class, that we might keep these review questions for Saturday and look at them together on Saturday. What we can do is that we can have copies of these review questions made for you, and you can have them tomorrow and in your free time, if you have any free time. In your free time, you can just look them over so that they don't come as a complete surprise. And then on Saturday, we can go through them together, answer them together, and that will help you to prepare for the midterm and help you also to review what we have done in this week's course. So if anyone has any comments or questions or any objections or suggestions with regard to these 2 points, the essays and the review questions, please let us know what you think about it and how you feel about it. Yeah, no, of course, but first let us get a little bit of feedback with regard to the, if anyone has any questions about the essays or about the review questions. anyone has anything they would like to clarify about that, then please ask that first, and then the remainder.
Those who are going to go for the credit, no, that is fine.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I had the impression. Yes, I mean those who are here, who are not doing the full course, they will
everybody
also.
Everybody has to take the exam here.
They can take it separately. IBC students will take it at IBC. Overseas students can take it at Tanxiang.
Right, but they all, if they want the certificate,
they have to take the exam.
They have to take the exam if they want the certificate.
And also write the
essay. So it is compulsory for everybody.
For everyone who wants credit, in other words, for everyone who wants a certificate. So does anyone have any? Yes.
Could you explain some more things about the Nirvana or Mahayana spectrum?
Well, the Nirvana of the Mahayana is, I think we can say quite simply that it isn't significantly different from the Mahayana of the Theravada if we look at those passages where it is made clear that Nirvana is indescribable and inexpressible, where we cannot say that it is existent, it is non-existent, it is both existent nor non-existent, that it is the highest bliss, and that it is peace, and that it is beyond all limitations and all worldly realities such as earth, water, fire, air, and the like. So I think that really there is not any real difference in the Mahayana of the Nirvana and the Mahayana of the Theravada. I think that what has happened is that some scholars and some people have tended to emphasize the negative aspects, or the negative descriptions of Nirvana, have tended to equate Nirvana with extinction, and have taken extinction as an end in itself, as equivalent to annihilation or to nothingness. And as I tried to explain this morning, what is meant by extinction or nirodha, cessation or extinction, what is meant is the extinction of the afflictions, the extinctions of ignorance and attachment and aversion, and the extinction, the end of karma. It doesn't mean extinction in an ontological sense. It doesn't mean extinction in a realistic sense. You remember what we read in the Kachyana Gota Sutta. The world is used to relying on existence and non-existence. The views of existence and non-existence are responsible for bondage. So what the Mahayana, the point that the Mahayana is trying to make is that Nirvana should not be conceived as non-existent, that we should leave Nirvana inconceivable, transcendental, inexpressible, that we can't pin Nirvana down. And this is in agreement with the fundamental teachings of the Buddha, even according to the Pali discourses. Some people have tended to think of Nirvana as non-existence or as annihilation, as extinction. And they haven't bothered to take into consideration that this is explicitly ruled out by the Buddha at many places, even in the Pali Canon. So I don't think that, you know, we have a real big difference in the view of Nirvana according to the Mahayana and the Theravada. What the Mahayana encourages people to strive for, of course, is something even beyond Nirvana, which is ultimate, supreme, and perfect enlightenment, Samyak Sambodhi, which is what the Buddha attained. So, in that sense, the Buddha attains Nirvana, but he also attains supreme and ultimate and perfect enlightenment. And along with that supreme and ultimate and perfect enlightenment, he also achieves all of these capabilities, all of these powers to help living beings, the knowledge of the mental states of living beings, the ability to teach in accordance with their capacity to understand the various powers of manifestation, miraculous powers, and so forth, some of which the arhats have, but not to the same degree as are possessed by the Buddha. So I think that in general one should keep this in mind, that Nirvana is inconceivable and inexpressible, and it is beyond the extremes of existence and non-existence. And if you bear that in mind, I think you will have a better appreciation of all the teachings of Buddhism, whether it be the Theravada teachings or the Mahayana teachings. Buddhism, the teaching of the Buddha is the teaching of the middle way. And one of the most important meanings of the middle way is to avoid existence and non-existence, to avoid the extremes of existence and non-existence. The Buddha said to Kacayana that it is because of relying on existence and non-existence that the world is in bondage, that people experience suffering and that people experience birth and death in the cycle of samsara. So to transcend, to go beyond, to give up, to abandon the extremes of existence and non-existence, this is probably the most profound and also the most difficult thing to do in Buddhism, because we are used to relying on existence and non-existence. I might even go so far as to say that our minds are programmed in a binary fashion. We are used to thinking in terms of is and is not, in terms of existence and non-existence. To abandon that, to be able to go beyond that, is to gain the middle way taught by the Buddhas. Once we have achieved that, then really the way to Nirvana and enlightenment is open. So I don't know, it's asking quite a lot of me to you know, in a few words, in the space of a few moments, to explain to you what Nirvana is, since I also don't know what Nirvana is, since I haven't experienced Nirvana, and we can't put Nirvana into words. So the only thing I can do is I can point to Nirvana. There's a passage in the Lankavatara Sutra that we're going to talk about later this week that was also taken up by the Chan and Zen tradition. It is the example of the finger pointing, in the case of the Zen story, the finger pointing at the moon. In the case of the Lankavatara Sutra, it's simply the finger pointing at anything. And people tend to take the finger as the thing. They look at the finger and not at the moon. And this is what happens when you find descriptions of Nirvana. When it's said Nirvana is beyond earth, water, fire, and air, then people say, ah, well, that is Nirvana. I know what Nirvana is now because it's beyond earth, water, fire, and air. And someone else will see Nirvana is supreme bliss, and then they will say, I know what Nirvana is. Nirvana is supreme bliss. But all of these descriptions of Nirvana are just like signposts. If you go out here on the highway, I'm sure you will see a signpost for Penang, or you will see a signpost for Suratani or Songkhla or Hatyai. Those signposts are not Suratani or Songkhla or Hatyai. They're not Penang. They're just signposts. You won't know what Penang is like until you go there. The signpost is only an indication. And it's the same way with Nirvana. Whatever we say about Nirvana is just a way of conveying, you know, some notion of Nirvana, hinting at Nirvana, just suggesting what Nirvana might be. You know, there's a very a silly little story, but it's quite helpful sometimes to make clear what exactly we can say and what we can't say about Nirvana. And it's the story of the turtle and the fish. Have you heard this story? You've all heard the story, right? Okay, well then I don't need to tell it again. But you see, if you don't experience it, it's very difficult, you know, to convey it in words. The red, the experiment about red, you know, is a similar case.
Yes. In Lotus Sutta, the chapter of the illustrious sitting, that means the arahant owning the such like the city. So whether the Western Pure Land also means the illustrious sitting?
The Western Pure Land. Well, the Western Pure Land, I don't think any Buddhist school, including the Pure Land School, I don't think any of the Buddhist schools claim that the Western Paradise, that the Pure Land, is the final goal. The Pure Land is a place where people train to become Buddhas eventually. So the Western Pure Land has a similar kind of status. Yes, you're right. I mean, the Western Pure Land is kind of like a college, you know, for future Buddhas. It's not supposed to be. People don't aspire to go to the Pure Land because they expect to stay forever in the Pure Land. They go to the Pure Land because it is easier to practice, easier to train for future Buddhahood in the Pure Land, because you don't have a lot of the obstacles that arise in this world because of evil-minded people and so on and so forth. So the Pure Land is just a sort of a training ground, a training camp for future Buddhas. It's not supposed to be a final destination. I think according to the proponents of Pure Land, they would not say that the Pure Land is the final goal. That is why it is a mistake when sometimes you see people liken the Pure Land to heaven in the Christian or Islamic traditions. That is mistaken. That is wrong, because heaven is the final destination for Christianity and Islam and so forth. For Buddhism, the Western Paradise is not the final destination. The Western Paradise or the Pure Land is just a good place to prepare. It's kind of a specially conducive to preparing for further progress on the path toward Buddhahood. Well, I mean, if I'm talking about Buddha in a Mahayana context, then I'm referring to a kind of enlightenment energy or enlightenment principle. If I'm talking about Buddha in a historical context or from the Theravada point of view, then I'm talking about the Buddha Shakyamuni. So you just have to see the context. I mean, I can try to make it a point to specify which definition, which interpretation I'm using. But I think in most cases it would be clear. I mean, you see, in a sense, I mean, in the Lotus Sutra there's a kind of blurring of the line, because it talks about the Buddha Shakyamuni, but the Buddha Shakyamuni is also the Buddha energy, the transcendental Buddha. It's just that when we talk about the Buddha Shakyamuni, we're talking about a particular manifestation of the transcendental Buddha. So the distinction is between the Buddha as a supramundane principle, as a supramundane enlightenment energy on the one hand, and the Buddha as an historical figure, as a manifestation in time and space. See, one thing about the Buddha Shakyamuni in the Lotus Sutra is that this is kind of outside time and space, no? In the sense that, yes, it's said that he's on the vulture peak and so forth, but he's not on the vulture peak that you and I see. It is a kind of a parallel reality. It's a reality that is outside the reality that we're familiar with. And this is true of, the Tushita heaven, for example, or any of the other worlds that Buddhism acknowledges. Somebody in between during the break asked me about the 31 planes and whether they were accepted in Mahayana. I said yes, except that Mahayana generally refers to six spheres, but the six spheres include the beings that are classified in terms of the 31 categories. So what about the sphere, what about the realm of the hungry ghosts? What about the realm of the demigods? Where are those realms? Where are they? I mean, are they on Mars? Are they on Neptune? Are they somewhere under the sea? Are they in the middle of the? Where are the hells? If we drill deep enough into the earth, will we find the hells? Well, no, of course not. They're parallel realities that depend on the mental condition of the beings who live there. They don't have any place in space as we know it, in geographical terms as we understand it. They're parallel realities that exist dependent on the karma of the beings who dwell there. Path originates historically from the collection of Arhat disciples, from the first five monks, from the other persons who were converted to the teaching of the Buddha, who did not pretend to be Buddhas, who were not recognized as Buddhas, who were recognized as followers, as disciples. This is the origin of the. If you want a better answer, let us say that the Hinayana path, or the Theravada path, or the whatever you want to call it, the fundamental path, it originated with the first sermon. It originated with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. When the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, that was the foundation of the Theravada path. Yes, but then that is not defined. That we don't know whether that is Theravada, Mahayana. Probably it is both. I mean, the Buddha said that his path that is an ancient path, that the goal that he taught is an ancient goal, but the precise nature of that goal is not specified. But certainly the fundamental path the Theravada path, Hinayana path, if you like. I don't like to use this word. I find it somewhat distasteful. But I think we can say it originated with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And then, of course, followed up by the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta and so on. If you mean by historical documentation, Mahayana Sutras, he's used it all over the place. Many times, even in these excerpts, the Buddha has talked about the great vehicle, the great way. So in the Mahayana Sutras, certainly the term Mahayana, you do find it in the mouth of the Buddha. In the Theravada discourses, to my knowledge, there is no direct reference to the great way. There is the reference to discourses dealing with Shunyata, and there are of course many references to the figure of the Bodhisattva. The figure of the Bodhisattva is referred to Sambodhi, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi is referred to. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no specific reference to the Great Way, to the Mahayana. But then there's no specific reference to the Theravada either. I mean, you don't see in the Pali Suttas, you don't find any references to the Theravada. I mean, these are, you know, scholastic names that were applied to different traditions later on in the course of the development of the Buddha, of Buddhism after the time of the Buddha. You know, there are many different versions of the life and the character of Mahakasyapa. If you look at the Theravada Vinaya and the stories in the Theravada tradition regarding Mahakasyapa, he was the great, the sort of archetypal, exemplary monk. If you look at the Sarvastivadin Vinaya, Mahakasyapa was more like a yogi. Mahakasyapa used to live in the forest. He had long hair. He used to come and a lot of the rich householders wouldn't even give him alms because he was too dirty and too wild looking. One time he was begging food from a leper and one of the leper's fingers fell into his alms bowl. And he ate it. So there are different images of Mahakasyapa depending on which Vinaya you look at. If you look at the Theravada Vinaya, Mahakasyapa is the perfect monk, the perfect organization person, the perfect institutional administrator. If you look at the Sarvastivada Vinaya, Mahakasyapa was a yogi, a very unconventional sort of person. So, when we look at figures like the figure of Mahakasyapa and so forth, we're looking at this figure from a distance of 2,500 years, and we're looking at him through different telescopes. You can look at him through the Theravada telescope, you can look at him through the Sarvastivada telescope. So, I would not like to I would not like to base my judgment upon what is real Buddhism or what is not Buddhism on the figure of Mahakasyapa or even on the figure of Nagarjuna for that matter. It is only because Nagarjuna, to my mind, interprets the teachings of the Buddha in a way that makes sense to me, that causes me to respect and venerate Nagarjuna. It's not simply the fact that he's called by Mahayanists the second Buddha. So I think we can look at these figures, you know, in their context, and we, after all, we need to see. Let us try to come to the real point. You know, doesn't matter whether we are monks or lay people or whatever. We are Buddhists. We are trying to get rid of our afflictions. We're trying to reduce our ignorance. We're trying to reduce our attachment, reduce our aversion. Let's not get too much entangled in the personalities or the the details, the minutia, you know, the tiny, you know, the details of the debates. Let's look at the teaching. Let's see how the teaching can help us. Let's put the teaching into practice. And as I said this morning, you know, if you feel uncomfortable with the Mahayana teachings, that's fine. I mean, there's no compunction here. That's the wonderful thing about Buddhism. We never had a pope. We never had a court to enforce any sort of punishment on heretics. Everyone was entitled to their own opinion. So the main thing is, take what you can from the teaching, put it into practice, work it out for yourself, you know. I mean, that's the only thing that I can say. Simply to say Mahakasipa came before Nagarjuna, therefore the Theravada tradition. Well, who was Mahakasipa? Maybe someone can go and find him in that mountain and see what he has to say. I mean, you know, I don't know. Okay.